Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So we did a trial run, or a little playtest of the newest D&D Next release. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was okay.
So you're not going to say anything. Well, I played with Wayne. He's not going to talk about it, but it was a lot of fun.
It felt like D&D.
Yeah,
to put it bluntly.
Yeah, and that's the great thing, because it hasn't felt like that in a while. Not since 3.5.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I was impressed with the modularity of race, class, background, and specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And you could really make a lot of different characters with that. I mean, some of the choices are better than others, and some of the choices I thought were kind of weak. But
yeah,
it's still a play test, so they haven't ironed everything out. But I know they're not going to do this, but I almost feel like they could stop after doing the four core classes: cleric, fighter, rogue, and wizard, and just have everything else be built with background and specialty and class options.
And, you know, I think it would actually really strengthen the game to do that, too, because it's a lot of fun building characters now. And I think if you could kind of put that much variability into it, where you could make a monk out of a thief or something like that, yeah, you could have a ton of fun, even more fun than it already is.
Yeah, I think I made a pretty decent ranger out of both the fighter class and the thief class.
Mm-hmm.
And you get into the problem of, okay, all these other classes, the mechanical and flavor design space is going to start to bleed over.
Yeah.
And each class has to be different, but the more you add, the less different they really are. So.
True. Yeah, overall, I mean, it was good. The combat was nice and quick. The combat rules seemed good, well put together. The skills seemed a little bit loose. Like, there's a few times where I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to call for ability rolls. I was running the game, by the way. Or if I should have called for skills. So that part needs some tweaking. But, yeah, overall, good.
Well, I think it's generally, like, all the rolls are ability rolls. Mm-hmm. And kind of if you have a skill that would help you, you know, you can pretty much use it.
That's the thing, though, is as a game master, I wasn't sure what to call for. For example, like, if something was trying to sneak up on you, like, in previous editions, I would call for a listen or a spot or a notice check, depending on what it is. But this time around, it seems that you're supposed to just call for the ability one, at least in the modules. That's what they say. This is a DC 13 ability check or something like that. But if you don't say that it's a skill check and you don't say what skill it is, then players who have that skill might not realize that they should be adding a bonus to it. Or there's also situations where, like, I think your character had a +3 to listening only. If he doesn't know that it's something to be listening for, then that +3 might go unnoticed.
Yeah, that's true. I think in the DM's guide, they said what you could do, what the player could do is make their ability check and say, oh, I got a 12. That's a 15 if this skill is applicable, which makes sense, but also seems, feels kind of clunky, a little bit weird to me.
Yeah, because then, you know, you could be wrong, or you could just be calling out stuff at random in hopes of getting a bonus. I don't know. Right. I think they should choose if they're going to make calls for skill checks or for ability checks, but it's a pretty minor point. It's just, I think it just needs a bit of tightening up on how everything runs together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't play that. So, I don't have much to add.
Tell by the 5 minutes of silence.
I think that's the longest Lyle's ever been silent on the podcast ever.
Well, that's good. Did any? So you played a quasi ranger there, Wayne?
No, I actually went with I built a quasi ranger. But I played as a sort of acrobatic thief.
Oh, okay. So what did Tom play?
I built a wizard for him.
Okay.
They did a pretty good job of sort of eliminating that, quote, that 5 minute work day.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can take an option where a lot of your spells are at wills. So I don't know if it'll please the 4E crowd, but it's not really the, okay, fire off all your spells and then stand at the back of the group where you can't do anything for being a wizard.
The balance was pretty good, though. I mean, when he was getting into the higher level, and when I say higher level, I mean like still first and second level spells, he was taking out pretty tough creatures just with one hit, kind of the typical glass cannon kind of thing. But when he got down to just the at-will ones, he was still effective, but not overpowered. So it was a good balance.
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard to judge since, like, at first level, anything you get hit with will take you out.
As a wizard, yeah.
Even me! Like, I build a bunch of characters, and I specifically kept an eye towards keeping the constitution score pretty high. Mm-hmm. So to you know, get more hit points.
Yep.
And still, I mean, both Tom and my character got one-shotted by a goblin archer.
Yeah, it's like, weird. You think you walk into an ambush and it's going to take you out? How strange.
Well, I mean, it wasn't. Okay, you walk into an ambush, yeah, you're going to get taken out. But when the adventure is like, okay, here's a cave, and you're like, well, all right, we got two choices, ignore it or go into it. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, let's go in. Oh, goblin, shot, dead. All right, let's start again.
So, yeah, it was good. It was good.
Isn't that what they're trying to avoid? Or why they made certain changes from 3 to 4 is to avoid the first level character getting taken out with the one hit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this adventure, we went into it with, because Yujiro forgot what day it was. Good job, Yuji. this adventure we went in with a thief and a wizard into, it was pretty much just a combat heavy dungeon crawl kind of thing. And they've survived about as well as you would expect one thief and one wizard to. Without somebody there to soak up some hits like a fighter or somebody to heal like a cleric. It was pretty rough going.
Yeah, I don't know. One of the kind of gripes I had with it was someone specifically asked the D&D team, okay, in D&D Next, what does being first level mean? You know, is it kind of more like the third edition where you're kind of just fresh off the farm, or is it more like fourth edition where you are already established kind of as a character? And in my opinion, the response was, it can be anything you want it to be, and they didn't give a clear answer, which kind of irritated me. And it's like, okay, how about you guys just choose one and set it at that? Because it feels to me as if they've reduced the healing and they've reduced the hit points on a lot of stuff. It feels like 3.5, where the fighter, even though he has all these abilities, is really just a guy who's traded his pitchfork for a sword.
No, like in some of the trial combats that we did, it was only with Tom at the time, but it was like I expected a wizard to be. I mean, he took out enemies in one hit, but he was taken out in one hit in the same grain. I'd like to actually try just a couple like little gladiatorial combats with all the different classes, especially the new ones like the monk.
I think it'd pretty much be the same thing. Whoever gets that first hit is going to win.
I wonder.
Yeah, don't invite
have to
me.
Play more.
I don't want to play a gladiatorial combat. It just tends to be like just roll dice.
Mm.
Mm. Oh, that's role playing in general. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So overall, I guess it was thumbs up. It sounds like
very much so. Yeah.
So you're liking the most recent playtest?
Yeah.
I'm still kind of neutral, as you'd expect.
Yeah. Hi.
I don't know. As a base system, I see a lot of potential. I could see this going better than 3.5, which is my favorite edition, and it's already better than 4, so.
Not to prolong the discussion, but you know what? It's different, but it doesn't feel any different than 3.5 to me. So, I don't know. I would kind of want to see something that felt new, because the rules are new, but I don't feel any different than playing 3rd edition.
Well, it's D&D Next, not D&D New.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You notice D&D Next, not D&D 5.
Mm.
Right.
Don't know what that means.
I think they'll probably change the name when they come out.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we did some movie reviews in our last episode, and it all ended up on the cutting room floor because I think we spent about 20 minutes reviewing some movies. So how about we do just a quick, you know, in 10 seconds or less, a quick review of those movies, okay? You know, to maybe save people some money or to point
some time.
A good movie.
Sure. You want to start, Lyle?
Okay, I watched Takers. I'll give it a thumbs up. It's heat for the hip-hop generation. Keep the expectations low.
Thumbs up if your expectations are low.
Yeah, low. Well, it's got Hayden Christensen, so that should help lower them.
Yeah.
And he was also good in another movie. So, not just Shattered Glass.
You're not talking about episode 1?
No.
Very much not.
He wasn't in episode 1.
That's right. Until 2.
You know, that wasn't him.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't, like, age, like, 20 years.
Fresh face, Liam.
No, he's excellent in Shattered Glass, which is also just an excellent movie. And Vanishing on 7th Street is a really good movie. And he is great in it. And that's directed by Brad Anderson, who did Session 9, which is an even better movie.
Without Christian Hayden.
And it happens to not have Christian Hayden.
All right.
My expectations are already higher.
Yeah. Oh, ouch.
And I saw Thatcher, which is one of your typical let's watch the person's entire history in flashbacks and marvel at the actor doing a good impression of somebody. I would give that a thumbs down.
Yeah, I was going to say, no thumb sideways.
Yeah, I'm not wishy-washy. Save your money.
Well, continuing on bad reviews, I saw Dark Shadows, which was a solid thumbs down. You know, that Johnny Depp vampire movie. It had the potential to be funny with the sort of culture clash from the 1700s vampire and 1970s family, and they just did nothing with it. Not enough jokes to hold the movie. Didn't really care about any of the characters. Solid thumbs down.
Right. I, as usual, didn't watch any movies.
As usual, except when you watch about 3 movies in a row. Yeah. And I just found out all my X-Wing stuff's in the country, as is my Game of Thrones, where I finally ordered the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game, Game of Thrones Edition. I already had the Pocket Edition.
Seeing how small Japan is in the country means it should be at your door shortly, right?
Well, they tried to deliver it today, and I got the parcel.
Oh,
no.
Don't you hate that?
Some poor postman sitting at the bottom of your stairwell crying.
Did you think customs called me? Oh, Lyle, we have your stuff.
No, I was just saying, like, don't you?
Just arrived in the port, we'll be sending it over in a couple days.
No, I was just remarking, like, you have a feeling something's going to be delivered that day, and you get home and there's the slip, and you're like, oh, a couple minutes or however longer. You couldn't have waited until I was actually home.
Yeah, you think after all these years they learn, eh?
It's
like, hey, why don't I try to deliver at 3 in the afternoon again? Oh, he's not home again.
On a weekday again? Come on, who's not home at 3 p.m. on a weekday?
All right. So today we're actually debuting a new series called Weapons. And the first up by request from, I believe, Wayne?
Was it me?
Or was it Chris?
I remember being excited about it, so maybe.
I remember not being me.
So first up by request by Not Lyle.
Not Lyle is swords. So we'll be doing an episode on swords. Now, the goal of these episodes, ideally, is going to be when you are making your character and you're choosing the weapons, you're going to be looking at more than just what damage die you roll or whether or not it gives you a bonus to hit. And just to kind of carefully consider is how the weapon can actually add to your role-playing. Did I come across that I was doing the R-O-L-E?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we'll be doing is talking about the role of the sword, both on the battlefield and in society. And this will be a two-part episode.
Because generally you look at like equipment lists for role-playing games, especially games like Dungeons & Dragons, and there's really not much difference between the weapons except in terms of damage die and cost. And so generally you just say, you know, I want the biggest, most damaging weapon that I can currently afford.
Mm-hmm. So. And there's so much more to it.
Exactly.
So what we're going to do today is, we'll be talking about, it's kind of the evolution of the sword. We're not going to be covering the entire history of the sword, and we're definitely not going to be able to cover every sword type that there ever was, but we'll try to pick out some, I guess, prominent or iconic sword types that really epitomize a certain type of role. You know, what was done in history, and then later on to talk about what could be done in your game using that. Okay?
Yep.
Sounds great.
All right. So we have to pick a start. So we are going to start with the Greeks, or at least use them to kick us off. And here we are. We're looking at a sword. If you look at the hoplites, you're looking at the sword as a secondary weapon. So the primary weapon was their spears. So the footman's sword, what we call that, what?
I believe it was, what, the Xiphos?
Xiphos, yeah. I'm trying to think. How do we pronounce that X again?
Yeah. I don't know. It's X-I-P-H-O-S.
Yeah.
I would say Xiphos.
Yeah, Xerxes is the person, so Xiphos. Yeah, that makes sense.
Xylophone is the instrument.
Yeah, xylophone. Yeah. There you go.
Much like a sword. Beware my mighty xylophone.
But we also see like a similar sword, like the Gladius is kind of the same idea. You have like a short sword that's, you know, kind of used to thrust and to chop.
Yeah, and he said that was kind of basically its role on the battlefield. Like I said, it was a secondary weapon, at least for like Greek hoplites, where it was only used, what, after they had thrown all their javelins and had actually closed with the enemy?
The Romans.
Okay.
The hoplites didn't.
Hoplites didn't generally throw their swords.
I didn't say they threw their sword.
No, you said they threw their javelins, but they didn't throw their spears. But like, if they got too close where they could, they got so close where they couldn't use their spears or broke or something like that, then, you know, they pull out the sword. The Romans, you know, give a couple thrusts, ideally to the abdomen. If not, then they would like hack at the legs.
Yeah, that's what I read too. It said the most common use was like to stab at abdomen or at stomach height, because, you know, gut wounds are usually pretty fatal.
But well, from what I saw about it, and this is referring to the Gladius, not the Xiphos. I didn't look up much on the Xiphos. But they're saying that a lot of the people that the Romans would fight against, specifically like the barbaric tribes, they'd use cruder weapons, which would often include hammers, clubs, and axes, which were big and heavy. So it would cause the opponents to swing wide, or they could easily disable them with their shield and open them up. And that's why a thrust to the abdomen was such an easy tactic. It was nice and deadly, and you had a good opportunity against those kinds of soldiers. There's a quote from a Roman drill sergeant that was, stick it in 3 inches, wait for him to cough, then look for your next target.
I like that.
Yeah.
And you're also looking at, like, opponents that primarily use their shield for defense. So once you get in close, they wouldn't have a lot of armor for their abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
So once you start to swing, that gives the opponent a chance to bring their shield into play. Mm-hmm. But if you get in close, you trap the shield, and then you just stick it in.
Yeah. So, now, I was imagining you also probably didn't have a lot of, you know, room to swing a sword when you got in close, so a stabbing or a thrusting motion would be better suited for tight quarters.
Oh, mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, in their formation or the Greek formation, yeah, they're all packed in close quarters. So it pretty much gets into, like, you know, what we would consider like equivalent of a rugby scrum or something.
Except with swords.
Except with swords, yeah. Now with swords.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually interesting. The design of the Gladius was, it was balanced, more towards the handle, which you wouldn't expect for a cutting weapon. So it was really good in close quarters because you could move it around and retrieve it, much more easily because it was balanced.
Yeah, I also read that the Gladius and possibly the Xiphos, but definitely the Gladius had like a ridged handle, you know, so that you could actually hold on to it better for all those stabbing and punching motions. Hmm. So I'm sure the last thing you want to do is, you know, lose your sword in the gut of the guy in front of you, and then yeah, kind of have nothing.
Well, you know, one of the things I was reading on it was saying that even though the Romans prized the thrust as kind of the best maneuver, and they actually looked down at you just swing it around like an axe, apparently due to wear on artifacts, they said that most soldiers, when it actually got into it, they just started swinging and going for whatever they could. And they said the wooden pels that they used to train on, they're just kind of these wooden pillars, and they weren't really good for practicing your thrust. So most soldiers were better trained and more accurate just hacking.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
But I also think that gets into a good point about just that style of combat when you are in just like very, very close quarters. And I think a lot of us imagine, you know, like the swordsman, and we watch those movies, and the really accomplished swordsman gets a little space so they can do all these maneuvers. But a lot of times you just press up really close, and you just go swinging. Swinging, you might be able to take out more than one guy. I mean, a thrust, you can actually, like, you know, extend yourself a little bit. You can actually miss somebody. A swing, you have a good chance of just hitting something.
Hopefully not your own guys.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting thing. The Romans, at least the earlier Romans, they drew from the right-hand side, even if they're right-handed.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that was another a good thing about having a short sword, is you could actually do that. Then they switched over to a left-hand draw.
Did I read that the centurions wore it on the opposite side to distinguish themselves?
Yeah, and then everybody kind of switched over to that.
Copycat.
Well, probably because they, hey, hold on.
This actually works better.
Yeah. Some reenactors tried it out, and with practice, you can actually draw it quite quickly. Maybe stuff would get in the way, I don't know. I can't imagine. Maybe the shield got in the way or something. If you go to the left, who knows?
Right.
And also considering you're in formation, there's people all around you, so drawing is probably a pretty dangerous motion.
Right. I'm sure there was a good reason for it, but it was doable. But of course, it's only doable with a short sword. But we see that like a common feature. If the sword doesn't have to be the primary weapon, then you're looking at something that's short, ideally balanced to be both thrusting and slashing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that kind of brings up some of the difference between, going back to the Greek ones, between the Xiphos and the Kolpis. Because the Kolpis, if anybody's familiar with, like, a kukri, it was kind of the same thing.
Right.
It was curved a little bit forward and the tip of it flared out, so it was heavier on the end. So, I mean, it's basically like an axe that's sharp all the way along. It's heavier on the front so you can get a stronger cut into it, and it's just to go at your enemy, as much as you can. It doesn't take much training to use something like that.
Yeah, I read that the Kolpis was a cavalry sword because it wasn't as versatile as the Xiphos, and the Xiphos was favored for infantry.
Uh-huh.
But if you're up on horseback, then you have that extra downward momentum of when you're attacking infantry. So the Kolpis was a favored cavalry sword because you just had that extra downward momentum and it, you know, just kind of hack into the guy. Yeah.
I'm actually really surprised by that. I didn't read about that, but like almost all the cavalry swords I know of, they had the curve backwards, kind of like a katana does, so that you have a better cutting surface while you're, you know, moving quickly. I'm actually really surprised that it was a cavalry weapon. Huh.
I think that's because like those curves.
It took them thousands of years to get there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, true.
Exactly.
True.
I think that's designed more for like a slice, you know, and that's what the curve helps you do.
Well, yeah, exactly. It allows you to. It's more surface area to draw out the cut longer,
yeah, but,
as you're against an enemy. But it also increases surface area, so it has a better chance to hit. So if you're riding by somebody and you go to slice them, all you have to do is hold the sword and you know, against them, and it'll slice them easily. But with a Kolpis, it'd be more of a single hit.
Right. As you said, the Kolpis was used more like an axe, where that flaring edge, called like a recurved blade, that was just extra weight.
That would be a vicious hit, though, on the horse, hey?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I mean, that's the next role, is like some proto cavalry swords, the Kolpis. Yeah, so much heavier swing down. But yeah, it shares a lot of similarities with the later cavalry sword. I think the difference there is that the cavalry sword, and you kind of like mentioned the katana with that longer slicing surface, we'll say, is they were generally attacking people with like weaker armor.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kolpis has to have a lot of penetrating power, whereas the saber, with the later cavalry man, he was attacking generally unarmed or unarmored opponents. And I guess, I guess in some cases, unarmored when the U.S. cavalry went through certain settlements.
Yeah.
You mean unarmored and unarmed?
Oh, dude.
What?
Yeah.
Hey, I didn't participate.
But I think that's a really good example of a contrast, is like, why choose one over the other and think about the armor? And this is going to come up again and again when we talk about the role of the sword in the battlefield, is you got to think of who you're actually fighting. And if you're fighting unarmed opponents, there's certain types, unarmed again. Well, really any sword.
Man,
would
you do. You just like striking down defenseless targets, don't you?
A knife, so, maybe?
So if you want to run like a quote-unquote cleansing campaign, then
ouch. That of an
I love how I got the, oh, dude.
Yeah. Sorry, an unarmored opponent. You're worried about, you're more concerned about just like that massive slicing surface so you could just hit anything.
Hmm.
Yeah. I've seen some games do a good job of like doing the penetrating power, but for the most part, they kind of ignore it.
Right.
Yeah, I've never found a system that I really like the mechanics on swordplay. I've seen people that divide it up between slicing and piercing and whatnot, but it's never smooth or easy enough to play.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Now, although like the Greek cavalry sword was the Kolpis, and like you said, almost an axe, you know, for the Romans, though, who had their own sword, the spatha, that's more like, I guess you call it like the proto-knight sword, the pre-medieval knight, so it's long and straight, edged on both sides.
Right.
Also like popular in gladiatorial fights, so, you know, kind of getting the idea of like a dueling sword.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That would have to be worn on the other side, I believe. All times it's just too long.
Yeah.
I think they said the average spatha was about like 75 to 100 centimeters long.
It was about leg length.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, sorry. I thought you said 175 centimeters long.
No, 75 to 100. That's what she said. Dude, you know how many times I've stifled one of those jokes when we're talking about all these thrusting moves?
Thrust it in the abdomen? That's what she said. What? That makes no sense. wait till he coughs.
It's curved for more slicing surface.
No, it was when Chris said, oh, you know, it's much more effective to do this thrusting motion than you just wave it about. And I'm like, all right, I thought that was funny. Jeez.
The penetrating power would have been funny if you had synced it up with that. Mm. I've never seen a game do a good job of penetrating power. Anyway.
Armor piercing.
Yes, anyway. The Spatha.
Yeah. So now that we're on horseback again, and actually we're probably going to stay on horseback for quite a bit when we talk about swords. So yeah, the Spatha, then you go into it, that kind of evolves and there's different types of swords. But kind of looking at like the next classic type of sword is the arming sword.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be in D&D terms would be your
longsword, wouldn't it?
Your longsword. So whereas the gladius or the zyphus would be your short sword, this would be your D&D longsword. But it actually, historians call it an arming.
Sorry to interrupt, but what would the spatha be? Do you think that'd be a short sword?
A long sword.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe your gladius would be the short sword.
That's what I said.
Then you said it well.
Oh, okay, sorry. I was getting a little confused there. Sorry, the arming sword and the spatha are about the same length.
Oh, so they are. All right. So the kind of interesting thing that I read about the arming sword was that they were typically used with a shield or buckler, but they could also just be used with an open hand for grabbing and grappling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something you don't tend to see in role-playing games. You know, like, usually you have a character who excels at grappling but then doesn't use a sword, or you have the guy with the long sword who only does attacks with that, but I haven't really seen anything that facilitated that one hand open for grabbing and grappling and wrestling in a game.
Well, yeah, when we talked about the Frankish knights back then, I mean, we were talking about how they wrestling was one of their big training regimens. So yeah, it's something that they definitely would have used. It really is a shame that you can't mix and match moves more realistically.
No, I think we probably touched upon this a little bit in Knights and Samurai, but yeah, I think one of the surprising things about the arming sword is the sheer versatility of it. And I'm not just saying about thrusting and slashing, which we saw, like, you know, the gladius had that same characteristics, but we're also talking about how they would use the cruciform or the hilt.
Right.
And, I mean, there's a couple reasons. I think, Chris, you're going to touch on one of the reasons for that shape. But the other reason is that you can actually use it as a punching weapon. Like, it can stab through somebody.
Right.
Yeah. Plus, it's double-edged, so they continue the double-edged style that you saw with the Romans and the Greeks. And that just gave them, you know, two ways. They can, they can cut forehand and backhand using tennis terminology there.
Forehand, backhand, reverse serve.
Yeah, when they served.
When they volley.
You know, I was looking at the Viking sword, which is just kind of another variation of the Spatha and arming sword. And apparently the Vikings had a two-handed style with this sword as well. And unlike like the bastard sword, which we'll talk about soon, this one, the handle wasn't large enough to actually hold it with two hands. But apparently they had this special grip where you would kind of hold your sword and then hold the hand holding the sword with your other hand, and you could kind of bring two-handed power into it.
Well, isn't that also kind of why the Viking sword had that large and heavy pommel as it act as a counterbalance for the blade, which was kind of traditionally held one-handed?
Well, some of the theories I read about it, which I think is totally awesome, whether it's true or not, is that the balance of the Viking sword was exactly on the cross guard. So theoretically, that you could use the sword as a thrown weapon. That's awesome.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's true or not. I just saw it online, but still, it's sweet.
Now, like the arming sword in its heyday is like where the knights weren't complete tanks on the horse, and the infantrymen definitely weren't. So there you had a pretty effective weapon that you could use both on foot or on horse.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the classic knight's weapon, so.
Yeah, pretty much. When you think of the sword a knight carries, this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the next sword that we're looking at is then the bastard sword, or I suppose as we commonly call it nowadays, the long sword.
Well, actually, we as in gamers, we would call it the bastard sword, but historians would call it the long sword.
I'm so confused.
Confused.
Basically, it's a little bit bigger version of the arming sword with a extra long handle that you can use both one or double handed.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the coolest European swords there is, I think. It's just so versatile. You can use it with your shield in the one hand. You can bring it in the two-handed weapon. Apparently, it was reinforced and strong enough with the grooves down the blade that you could use it in a full-on charge to against cavalry, and you could still drive it into the horse without it snapping. Apparently, it's just
horse.
A great weapon.
It was the Ginsu knife of the medieval age.
Yes.
Cut to the shoe.
There was a Chinese sword. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was translated to horse cutter, and it was pretty much the Chinese version of the longsword.
Horse cutter.
Yeah.
Not good for cutting men, only horses.
I think, yeah, this is something that comes into play when, I guess, you're starting to see more armor, so you need something that you can actually use two hands to give it that optimal thrust or even the optimal slash.
Right.
But at this point, you're starting to see the armor get to the stage where the swords have a lot of trouble cutting through it, so they need to thrust through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like what I read is, like, at the beginning when full plate armor showed up, you could still kind of get away with a double-handed slash, and instead of becoming cutting power, the blow just was like pure concussive force. But that got more and more dangerous as plate armor got better, because you could like just snap your sword or just completely, you know, damage your sword to the point where it was non-functional if you just tried to like slash at someone in full plate armor.
Yeah, I think like with half plate, the sword was still okay. Because there was still enough places where, like, the joints or the places that weren't covered in plate that you could go for.
Right.
But once you hit full plate armor, which also, like, had a lot of protection around the joints, then it would just pretty much slide off, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Or break.
And the knights almost, like, reverted back to, of course, they go to the bastard sword, as Chris said, but also they reverted to the hoplites and the legionnaires is they get, like, a short thrusting weapon, like a dagger. When they get like real close quarters and then like stick that in the guy's chin or something like that.
What's that? A poniard through the eye slit?
Or that too?
that'll
you want to get real gritty? Yeah.
I guess one of the other names for the arming sword that we were talking about earlier was the side sword, and apparently, in addition to the slightly larger version, the bastard sword, the knights also kept this arming sword on, so they had basically two full-size swords on them. And the reason for keeping the side sword around was because it was light enough that you could maneuver it and strike at those joints and try and bring somebody down that way, because the full plate just wasn't, you couldn't go through it.
I could see that. And again, I guess similar to what we said, or I haven't really seen a game that can emulate that one-hand open style using the arming sword.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm surprised you didn't bring this up, Chris, but with the long sword, like the whole sword was a weapon, kind of as we said with like other swords, like the cross guard and the hilt could be, you know, used to like, yeah, poke out an eye, or one of the moves is called like a Mordstreck, which literally translates as murder stroke from German. And you actually held the blade of the sword and used the cross guard as a hammer.
That's pretty nasty.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty nasty. Or another move was called like half sword fighting, where you actually held the blade with
one
or two hands, and that was just to get an even better grip on the sword to deliver that thrust that would go through either the joint or even probably just go through some of the weaker points of the armor, as opposed to just slashing with the long sword.
I read the same thing, and they said like later iterations of the sword, near the handguard, the blade was either dulled or just not sharpened at all, so that you could reach up there and grab hold of it to get more maneuverability.
Yeah, you see that in a lot of those swords, and actually it looks strange, but if you watch Excalibur, and Lancelot fights another knight, gosh, was it Gawain or was it Arthur? Anyway, he fights maybe Gawain, and they're using these really odd things, and they're not actually the bastard sword, or really, the two-handed sword is just a slight variation of the bastard sword, but the style of fight, they look like mini lances, but that style of fighting, what they're doing, like a lot of thrusting, is very much probably what you would expect to see with two people fighting with a bastard sword.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's like if you have this, you're really going to also have the arming sword or something, because it's mm-hmm. not the most maneuverable of swords. And I think, like, yeah. you know, when you watch a Game of Thrones and that tiny Kit Harington playing Jon Snow has got this bastard sword, and you're like, oh, come on, guy.
But it is made from Valyrian steel, light as a feather.
Yeah.
And this is kind of where the swords started to diverge when this really heavy plate came out as well, because then they started to move towards the more specialized things, such as the claymore, which you can use as partly as a bludgeoning weapon, or more towards a sabre or a rapier, the lighter, thinner swords that you can use against lighter armored targets or against the joints and vital points of a fully suited person.
Hmm. Yeah, I think at this time, you pretty much the sword's no longer the king of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and by the rapier, yeah, there's a few variations of the rapier, but they're all like kind of the same style as
mm-hmm.
you know, like a small sword is another yeah. variation, or is pretty much just like a thrusting weapon with mm-hmm. Like kind of a basket hilt,
right?
And yeah. even that's not terribly effective against anybody with any armor, but by this point, with guns entering the battlefield, people just kind of gave up on armor.
Yeah. Right.
And it's that started to scale down. And then we start to see like things like later on the saber,
mm-hmm.
the slightly more modern version of the coppice.
That long, yeah, curved cutting edge.
Yeah, there's kind of another split in the styles there, is where some countries went more towards the rapier and that more precise, like thrusting, fencing kind of cut, whereas others went for the heavier rapier thing. I read on a webpage, I don't know if it's correct or not, but it theorized that a lot of the southern European countries, like Italy and Spain and France or whatnot, they used rapiers more commonly because they had a lighter build than people like England and Germany. They had a bigger, heavier build, so they preferred something with more power behind it, like a cutting weapon, like the saber.
Yeah, or even like the broadsword. If you look at like the broadsword, a lot of them would have basket hilt. And
right.
Yeah, almost like with like the pirate sword, you know, you look at the cutlass, but actually mm-hmm. that looks a lot like what the broadsword would be, and that, yeah, it's more of a slashing, almost like a regression in swords.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like much cruder, but it just was more, well, I guess
probably had more weight behind it, more slashing power with that curved yeah. edge, maybe cut through, you know, whatever breastplate the guy was wearing, because probably at that point, yeah, as you said, Lyle, armor kind of had regressed to kind of a ceremonial or ornamental breastplate.
Yeah, well, yeah, when you're getting to that point, you're only going to have the one piece of armor maybe to protect your vital areas, but your arms and legs are pretty much uncovered.
Right.
You know, the armor actually did a bit of aggression as well, because this, they got the steel to, like, pretty advanced state where it was, like, really light, and they could make these elaborate full-plate armor, but musket balls would just punch right through it,
mm-hmm.
or whatever the firearm of the day was, and they would punch right through it, but then if they switched to, like, a cruder iron breastplate, the firearms couldn't punch through that. They would only dent it. Hmm. But of course it was really heavy, so they just like stripped it down so they would only have like breastplates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the full plate went. It was gone. Yeah, it's funny how like,
yeah.
you know, you go a couple steps forward on one end that you gotta go do a couple steps backwards on the other to counteract it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I can see wearing only the breastplate though. Cause, I mean, you get shot, well, apart from the head, but you get shot in any of your limbs, well, but you might survive. You know, take a musket ball to the chest or, you know, somewhere in the abdomen, you know, game over.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting that a lot of the swords in other parts of the world, they kind of took that step a lot earlier because not many other places developed like full suits of armor. And even places that did, they weren't nearly as good and as protective as the European ones. Like you look at the Middle East and India, they had their scimitars and they had that long curved cutting edge. Again, like the katana. Did because you know that's if you're going against unarmored targets, that's one of the best ways to just lop limbs right off.
Yeah, nice long cutting surface.
Hey, you know, I found out something pretty nifty. You know, the Indian scimitar was called a talwar. They were one of the first people to make steel, like Damascus steel, and the original Indian steel was called Wootz steel.
Oh, geez, Wootz. I knew it.
Yep.
How did I not know you would bring that up when I saw it? I should have known better.
I don't believe there's a ban on saying certain types of steel. Whoops.
Oh, gee.
All right, and moving on.
from that deep point.
Now, we focused primarily on Europe, and the reason for that, because there is that rapid evolution. But we'll take a pause from the continent of Europe and move over to Japan, which has a... because we're podcasting from Japan. But also, it has a slightly different evolution. And part of it is, like, what Chris is saying is that
the lack of evolution.
Yeah. I was trying to think about how do I put that? I was like, stagnation? Yeah. one thing is that things that they didn't have to deal with were, shields.
Yeah.
Right. Heavy plate armor?
They actually got, like, they probably got about half plate, the equivalent of half plate.
Mm-hmm.
Sophisticated half plate. And then once they stopped fighting wars, they're like, enough of this. Go back to the old stuff.
Yeah.
One expert who compared the katana and the arming sword or the D&D long sword, when he was saying, like, which one was a better sword, he said that one thing is the katana has no answer for the shield. It can't cut through the shield. Mm-hmm. It can't do anything with it. And as Chris is saying, it's designed for like a long slicing surface, which is kind of useless mm-hmm. against full plate and a shield.
Yeah.
While I know thousands of geeks out there listening to this are just, they don't know what's wrong, what there's a disturbance in the force, someone's bad mouthing the katana. Watch out.
Well, right. You know, I mean, yeah, I'm a huge fan of the katana because I think it's just such a well-designed sword. It had that long curving edge so you could make these drastic cuts, even through the lacquered armor that the Japanese had at the time. With its mix of metals, you had the hard metal on the front to keep a really razor-sharp edge, but the soft metal in the back so that you could, even throughout the whole stroke, the sword kept pressure on it. I mean, it's probably one of the best cutting swords ever made. But the thing is, the design of it is so specialized to go at cutting pieces and things off of people, but it's not versatile at all. It's probably one of the best swords out there for a duel or for a one-on-one fight, but not for a battle. I don't see it being that useful because you can't really thrust with it. You can't backstroke with it, to use a swimming instead of tennis term. Yeah, it's just, but that said, I still like it a lot.
You're right about its role in the battlefield. I mean, it's funny how it did get this elevated status because originally the samurai were master archers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a way to decide things. And then, of course, they used the katana, but when they were facing people with naginatas or yadis, like spears and halberds, then they were at a disadvantage. And there's that, like, kind of a, let's say, a Japanese greatsword called the nodachi, which mm-hmm. was similar to the bastard sword or claymore that, probably kind of like a cavalry version of the bastard sword. But mm-hmm. they said that it wasn't really that used because actually if a foot soldier was going to fight a cavalry person, they would just use a naginata.
Yeah.
And it was okay on horseback, but it wasn't anything terribly special, so.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the culture of the country. And you see this in other places as well. The Japanese loved the idea of this one-on-one fight, you know, the perfect duel. That was something that they wrote about and, they just legendized? Is that a word? Anyway. But, you saw that with the Romans too. The Romans thought that the thrusting move was the best possible, the most manly move, and slashing around like with your gladius was not. So the gladius was well designed for doing thrusts, but it wasn't as well designed for doing cutting actions, yet that's what the most common thing was. So some difference between what people thought was the best thing to do and what actually worked.
Oh, yeah, there's that. And also, like, I don't think Europe could afford to get too sentimental about their weapons.
Mm, good point.
I mean, they did hold on to their sword as much as they could and tried to keep that on the battlefield and things like that. But I mean, if you're losing like battle after battle with other countries that are, you know, less sentimental.
Not using swords.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, the Swiss guard, deviation, but when the Swiss pikemen are dominating the battlefield and everybody who's like sitting there with the swords going, oh, that's kind of, we better get some pikes. And
then
when the
we fire. Should do something.
Yeah, what are those long things they have? And then when the
swords
fire.
On sticks.
Firearms are making them kind of obsolete, then everybody's like switching over to that. So, like, whereas Japan did have that luxury. And actually, one thing that does add to the mystique of the katana is that they were able to keep the craft going, mm-hmm. like, quite close to the modern era. Well, actually, it's still going right now. Whereas, right. like, people who are master arming sword makers or swordsmiths
mm-hmm.
just stopped because no one was buying their swords or anything, so they switch over to something else.
Yeah, gun barrels.
I actually have a knife that was supposedly made by one of the sword making families here in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You have a knife?
Yeah, like it's a kitchen knife, but you can actually see like, you know, like the rippled markings in the blade from all the times they had to fold the metal over.
Oh, I have a knife like that.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, so probably there were, like, if you take the craftsmen of their day for the arming sword and the craftsmen of the day from katana, they would be probably about just as good,
yeah,
about the same, but they didn't have that, I don't know, mystique in Europe as they do mm-hmm. in Japan now. You know, I'm going to say, you know, we talk about, but what's the role? Yeah, it's the ultimate dueling sword. That's very true, Chris. It's also used in a ritual of like beheading or the, when you behead your enemies. And it's not just the harakiri or seppuku, but also just they would just behead people after a battle, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were mad about beheading.
They're all over that.
They just love them some beheading. Yeah, no, they would like cut off a lot of heads. You know, there's that one story, I think we might have mentioned in an earlier episode where like an old samurai like dyed his hair black and the guy didn't recognize him until like his head got wet and the dye came off and you're like, oh, another sweet story from samurai Japanese history.
Oh yeah, where someone beheaded someone to save
them. Oh, it's my old friend's head. As I was counting heads, I didn't realize the 325th one was my old friend and mentor.
Hey, when you have so many of them, you start noticing little details.
I'm choked up.
All I could do to console myself was go chop off some more heads.
Yeah, it's just like, well, what should we do with this head? And you're like, well, it's just a head, really. Just like, do whatever you do with all the other heads.
Mm. But, you know, like that's actually a good point. There's the katana, I think more so than almost any of the other swords that we've talked about so far, had so much pomp and ritual behind it. The Japanese were love ceremony to this day, very much so. And just everything about it, though, there's different ways that you have to set it down when you're done with it. You have to make sure to wipe the blood off of it before you resheath it. There's even the rule, supposedly, where if you draw more than 2 fingers length out of the scabbard, and not long, 2 fingers width, rather, then you can't return it until it's tasted blood. All kinds of stuff. I mean, the society was of the warriors was totally based around this sword.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, hold that thought about society and the sword, because we're just wrapping up the role in the battlefield. And the final one we chose, it gets into where the sword is now a tool. And this is arguably where the sword is no longer becoming a sword, it's becoming just a long knife. And it's one of the names for it is a fashin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And its primary function was, it's a secondary weapon. Like, fighting is not even the primary function. The primary function is a tool. So it's like a chopping tool, like to chop down, you know, branches and things like that.
So like a machete. Mm-hmm.
Like a machete. And actually, the Spanish called it a machete, although it's not what your image would be of a machete. It's actually a straight heavy blade, as opposed to the kind of billowing out blade of a machete.
Right.
Yeah.
But serving pretty much the same function as a machete in that, yeah, its primary function is to cut down. And sure, if you're going to get into a fight and you don't have any bullets, yeah, I'll use the machete.
Mm-hmm.
Cut through flesh just as easily as wood.
Probably so.
Perhaps even a little easier.
Yeah.
Except trees don't scream.
That's true.
Yeah. But as Chris said, now the next thing we want to talk about is the role of the sword in society.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, yeah, is a classic example of that. Right, Chris?
Yes, yes, indeed it is.
do you want him to say all the stuff you just said again?
For a lot of time and across a lot of cultures, not that many people could either A, afford weapons, swords specifically, or B, were allowed to carry them. So just having a sword really designated you as someone special, someone dangerous, someone of authority, or perhaps of position for it. And that's something that you can bring into games as well, is that if your character has a sword that might make him somebody, depending on your campaign, of course.
Yeah, they definitely linked it, but I think we find this on a lot of societies, or later European societies, where the warrior class is tied to the sword, such as the Knight of the Samurai, and mm-hmm. as its role on the battlefield is declining, they kind of lock it in and everything becomes ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Just in Europe, they kind of just switched over to the more modern swords. Like the rapier, small sword.
Yeah.
And then just made like fashionable versions of that. I guess you would have to give the samurai props in that for the most part, they would, except when they sold their blades because they were so poor, but for the most part, mm-hmm. the swords were still functional.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just something to consider and something that could be interesting to use is that even though it's not the most effective weapon, but it is a status symbol. And you can see this in some like fantasy cultures. It's like if you're the dwarf, you know, they want to shake it up a bit, and they say, hey, the axe is the status symbol in a mm-hmm. dwarven culture, or a hammer.
Elves have their bows, yeah.
Yeah, or their swords. With the Romans, they kind of linked it with gladius, or a variation of that word, gladia or whatever, means like mm-hmm. swordsmanship. So gladiator, you know, your ultimate duelist. And they were celebrities. And certainly the ones that used the sword were the, you know, the celebrity of the celebrity.
Yeah, there's also a lot of fame attached to someone who uses the sword.
Well, I mean, you know, you think about the Vikings, and you did mention, or Wayne mentioned about the Viking sword earlier in the episode, but some people might associate the Viking with the battle axe, or because of the hammer of Thor, Midjorn.
Mm-hmm.
They might think, oh, well, you know, the Warhammer or something like that. But no, the Vikings valued the sword as well, and that was the noble weapon. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that that's just a lot of metal.
Yeah. Yes. A lot of metal, a lot of man behind it.
So yeah, it took a lot of craftsmanship to get a pretty decent sword, and it also took a lot of metal to make one.
Well, that's a good point. Like, swords, they take a lot of metal and a lot of expertise to make it, at least to make a good one. So yeah, that is a point that not everyone can afford it. And that's the thing as well, that a lot of people who own swords, they received them from their father and who got it from their father's father, etc. These were family heirlooms that went from generation to generation because they were masterpieces. It's something to say that in a game, your sword can have as big a backstory as your character does.
I think we brought that up before, and it's kind of a shame where in some games, like, you just kind of chuck the sword that you had whenever you get that newer one that's just a little bit better.
Yeah,
where,
yeah.
You know, in reality, you probably, well, I mean, suppose if you found, like, a better one, yeah, you probably would chuck it, but it'd be pretty rare to actually find one that's better, and it's like, no, I'm going to hold on to this one because it's special, and yeah, I'm probably not going to see another one for a while.
Well, I try to do that in my campaigns a little bit. Whenever somebody gets a weapon that's something special, like a plus, even of just a plus one sword, I always ask them to name it just to give it some attention.
I name it plus one, the third.
There have been some pretty interesting ones. Yuji's one was called the poker.
Truth in advertising. It did what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our first episode of Weapons, where we focused on the sword. Join us next week for part two, or look more closely at swords and gaming. So later episodes will focus on a different weapon type, be it modern or archaic.
Yeah,
Wrapping that up.
Thanks, Lyle. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the webpage, or you can listen to it through iTunes off of Stitcher, or download the episode off of DriveThruRPG. You can post comments right there on the webpage through our forums, which is linked to send us an email, or post on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And thank you again, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.
Do we have any more to say about the katana other than how shit it is, or is there anything?
Nope.
Sorry, like, we just kind of
nope
shat all over that.